Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted and privileged to welcome not just a very dear friend, a fellow member of the YPO, but a person who is a reader of Chinese history and deeply interested in exploring the road of modernization of China, Mr. Water Cheung Chung Wing. Water, in his professional life, is the senior partner and chief executive officer of Storm Harbor Securities. He's with the chairman of Carbon Care Asia and has earlier been with DBS, RBS, CIBC, and Chase Manhattan Bank. Water is also an avid fintech investor who is involved in the tokenization of financial assets. He's a columnist with several Hong Kong newspapers and magazines. And as I mentioned, Water is a fellow member of the YPO. So Water, before we start talking about our subject today, which is how Xi Jinping's foreign policy is driven by domestic agenda, tell me a little bit about the background of China and what makes China tick.
Well, China is a huge country, but I'm sharing a bit of a few general comments on the concept of what is a nation. A nation is a relatively new concept to the Chinese people. We used to have dynasty. I think the concept of nation is being brought in during the early 20th century. So it's been 100 plus year old, that concept. If you're going to define, and China is always very proud of our heritage. So we keep saying that we have 5,000 years of history and presumably uninterrupted history, which is nothing compared to India. India have even a longer and longer culture than that. But to be very precise, if you define a nation by the race, okay, and the majority of Chinese people today are Han, so right? There's two major dynasties, the Ming dynasty and not the Ming, the Yuan dynasty and also the Qing dynasty that was actually governed by non-Hans. So you can argue the nation actually has broken off or whatnot. But we conveniently ignore that fact. We still keep ourselves a nation of 5,000 years of history. And if you move the lens a bit more forward to the recent 100 or 150 years, towards the end of the Qing dynasty, of course, China have suffered a lot of invasion by the colonial power. So people feel a bit, and politicians, both the Communist Party as well as the KMT, the Kuomintang, also exploits that sentiment to reinforce the controlling power. Unfortunately, the population developed a bit of inferiority complex. And so with the rally or the economic development of the past 30 years, there's some desire of overcompensating that shortcoming in history. And I think that leads to a lot of the foreign policy and also a lot of the political decision made by Xi.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And so let's now move to Mr. Xi Jinping, you know, a very, very tall leader in the world. But let me start by asking you, how would you describe the core principles of presidency's foreign policy? And how do they connect with China's domestic priorities?
I think in all policy, the first and foremost objective is the preservation of the party's power. Okay, that's first and foremost. Economics used to come quite low in the agenda. In fact, I would surely would call this a second or third fiddle. So even though in terms of the foreign policy is how to mobilize the loyalty of domestic people rather than and China naturally. I don't think China have a territorial ambitions. Okay, so the domestic issue are the driving force of a lot of these decisions.
Mm-hmm.
I could even argue the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Beijing probably is the worst PR machine in the world.
Wow, that's a strong statement.
in fact, the tune that they're pitching sometimes don't sit well with a lot of Western ears. But so be it, because the target audience is not a Wall Street Journal reporter. The target audience is a poor person who is earning maybe $2,000 a year, living in inbound provinces in a poor part of China. But that link up to my first and foremost point is the preservation of power that is the key. Yeah.
Very interesting. And what are some of the domestic issues that are most influential in shaping Xi's foreign policy decisions? And I would love you to talk about this whole thing of the expansionism of Chinese, China, which the whole world press talks about.
I think stability is the key thing, right? Stability leads to preservation of power. So sometimes you need to use a diversion of attention to stabilize the country, so that if the economy is suffering, the more it is, the more you need to have a common foreign enemies to divert the focus. In my own opinion, it's not necessarily the very rational way of doing things. Also, it's like fueling a flame. When it's easy to start the fire, but the time and how to stop it always a challenge.
Correct.
I'm quite cautious on that approach. Sorry, I missed your second part of the questions. Yeah.
Which was the expansionism, because a lot of people say that this policy of China to keep on wanting more and more territory.
Even if
they have to go back 5,000 years.
I don't buy that. I think, first of all, if you look at, well, China, half of the border are sea, the ocean border, half of them are mountains, right? If you're talking about the ocean power, okay, if you're talking about ocean power, up until very recently, and go back to the two dynasties preceding the Republic, both the Qing Dynasty and the Ming Dynasty, there has been a very explicit policy not to open up the seashore. It's not that we don't have the technology. In fact, if I can share one picture, I think that adds a bit more interesting flavor to the point I try to illustrate now.
Yeah.
In the picture, you can see there is two ships, okay? One, a huge one with a yellow flag. That's a ship used by Zheng He. Zheng He, you probably arguable, he's come from the Ming Dynasty. He's probably arguably the most famous sailors from coming out from China. And the smaller ship with a red sail, and I believe this could be a Portuguese or Spanish sign. That's a ship or a boat used by Colombo.
Marco Polo.
You can see they are contemporary. All come from good 16 centuries.
Yeah.
16th or 17th centuries. But. The sea power or the technology engaged by the Chinese are far more advanced than the Portuguese or the Spanish at that time.
Right. So,
but we did not use it to conquer more territories. Because we don't think there's a necessary thing of doing it. Today, maybe on a more micro level, people look at the air carrier like engaged by the China and feel that that's a military threat. I still go back to my overriding theme. I think the show of the military mighty is to the domestic people.
Right.
It's not to conquer. And in fact, when push come to shuffle and say, when the tension at the Taiwan Strait got escalated, the PLA leadership was very smart, or they have no choice, to advise Xi that our military might is still far below the American one. And so when push come to shove, I think China will not initiate a war in that sense.
Right.
The Very only true. Exception, the only exception is regarding Taiwan.
Taiwan.
The regarding Taiwan. And talking something maybe closer to home to the people in to my friends in India. The territorial conflict between China and India in the Himalayan mountains, that conflict was not widely reported in the domestic media. I believe it's for a number of reasons. One, I mean, in the Chinese eyes, India remain one of the non-aligned potential partner in the global geopolitics. They need to see it a comradeship. Of course, Biden just like kiss Modi, and I mean, that doesn't make Chinese feel comfortable, but I think this is geopolitics, right? So I think India for sure is a preferred partner. If China look around and look at some significant country, India is one of them. And economically, India remains up to now a very popular destination for Chinese capital and goods.
Right. So
that's another thinking. And again, go back to the history or the memory. India was never a colonial power or invader to China in that sense. In fact, the culture, you can trace the heritage. A lot of the Chinese culture, like the Buddhism, are rooted from India. So I mean, for a lot of reason, because I got a lot of very good Indian friends, including you, and I also read a bit of the local domestic news in India. As an example, the conflict last time was actually played down big time in China, but it was much widely reported in India.
It was. You're right, absolutely. But my next question, Walter, is that President Xi's focus on nationalism within China, how has that influenced China's stance on global issues?
Big time. Because if I can rank the priority of Xi, first of all, it believe in ideology. And he's a big fan of Mao Zedong, which I think is a misplaced interest. So he believed in ideology. He believed in a strong nation, and in his agenda, foreign policy probably ranked 7 or 8. The economy probably ranked 4 or 5. To build the country with everyone looking very introvert and it's probably his top priority. And So sometimes when you conduct a foreign policy, you need to look at other people, how people will see that message, right? But China hasn't been doing that great a job in terms of delivering a message.
Hmm.
We always kid ourselves at the fact that the Americans are very good at sugarcoating all the message.
Hmm.
And if I'm a salesman from the Mars, I'm a Martian, a salesman from the Mars, and I have two systems to market. One is the freedom, capitalism, individualism coming from the West. And the other one is the totalitarian, the heavily regulated central market belief or system in China.
Yeah.
The first product is definitely much easier to be sold than the second one, right? And I think in that sense, by adopting a certain system, which I think worked in a certain period of time for China as a developing economy, so I'm not totally discrediting that system, but if you try to sell the two product to a totally independent party,
correct,
then the Western world thinking definitely have the advantage in that sense.
Very interesting. But I'd also love to get your perspective on how Xi Jinping's foreign policy reflects the historical context of China's domestic political philosophy.
There's no such thing as domestic. I think the common thread is the nationalism. I think that drives the domestic policy. That equally drives the foreign policy. Something I do want to share a bit more is if I try to look into the future, I think the best outcome, and talking about this ideology competition, the crux of that conflict is because the West now are seeing there's a growing and substantial economic power that with a diagonally opposite ideology that is contending the world's leadership, and so this is nothing about trade deficit or whatnot. This is crush of ideology, and this is very difficult to resolve. Having said that, personally, I think the best outcome will be one, both sides recognize there's an economic dependency, which is good for both and good for the rest of the world. Okay, and second is, one system is not trying to overturn or conquer the other system. I think that's sense of security. Both sides need to give each other, and then they can find the truth in the middle, and try to coexist. Because I personally don't want to see a war anywhere. I think
absolutely,
yeah, the politicians are committing a big crime if they try to go down that.
Absolutely right. Absolutely, I completely agree with you. Yeah. But let me now move on, Walter. One major initiative of President Xi's foreign policy was the Belt and Road Initiative. And billions and billions of dollars have been spent by China and the other countries. And very recently, the Italian Prime Minister said we are going to be signing off. I wanted to ask you about the Belt and Road Initiative. And it's linked to China's internal economic and political agenda.
I personally, my shop's involved in raising some capital on the Belt and Road project. So I do have a first-hand experience in dealing with that initiative. At the outset, the economic makes sense, okay? China has spare capacity in cement plant, iron plant, steel plant. So there are a lot of construction company, huge construction contractor company. So it's good. And the China economy last time was driven by FDI. At a certain point now, building a new additional airport, a new highway, a new train doesn't really help. It's probably on a marginal basis. It's a negative return to the GDP. Mm-hmm. So they have all this capacity. They need to find place to gainfully use it. So a nice way will be I ship this out and go to Pakistan, go to wherever, Middle East, and then build road, build factory, build nuclear plant for them. And then at that time, the Chinese banks also have a huge balance sheet, okay? The Chinese bank remain having the largest balance sheet in the world as of today. Because they have absorbed so much deposit from saving from the domestic people. So the bank also are willing to lend at the back of this project.
Yeah.
So on surface, this is a something that kill many birds with one stone. But at the end of the day, and then we start entering into a downward cycle of the global economy. This project itself doesn't make economic sense. So you have a lot of debt. Up till today, the Chinese government is still very reluctant to forgive the debt because that will affect the health of the balance sheet of their major banks. So that's still something need to be resolved. But the problem right now is those projects didn't yield the economic benefit as people expected. Okay. And capacity has been spent, but a loan has been made. Now the repayment is an issue. So we are at the point of this juncture. And talking about foreign policy, right? You can see Chinese deploy a lot of resources and both financial resources and also know-how into this country along the One Belt, One Road path. But the political goodie, I would say they are not getting a lot of political goodie from that one. You look at the influence of the Russia in Africa, okay? You look at how American build the network. I think Chinese has been a very poor investor of all these economic bullets in return for very little political goodwill, unfortunately. And part of it is, at the end of the day, Chinese is quite amateur in terms of dealing with foreign relationship or go to a place, if you're carrying a government flag and go to a place and how to make friends and build influence. I think they are still learning the rope and not very experienced in doing
Fascinating. My next question to you, Walter, is that, you know, when I compare India and China, the people in India and China, the Indian common person has a very strong public opinion on what its government is doing.
Yeah.
What role does public opinion play within China in shaping the government's foreign policy?
It's interesting. Yeah. It used to be, go back 20, 30 years ago, when I start doing some business, well, I work with foreign bank and we make investment in India. And typically, I remember last time when we set up an apartment for my expatriate stuff in Mumbai, it's the most expensive expatriate apartment in the world. And typically the feedback from the foreign investor is, oh, the place is so political. I mean, so much things has been spent. I'm sure things are getting better. But you're absolutely right.
No, that's as far as politics is concerned, Indians love to discuss politics.
Yeah, exactly. Chinese is, you rightly point out, is quite the opposite. Yeah. We care a lot about our family. We care a lot about our business. the government is just a necessary devil, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's why we have a lot of tolerance on poor governance, okay? If we got a poor leadership, we'll say, oh, eventually he may die, a new empire will come out, and then we'll be okay. Mm. So we are not engaging. One, we are not engaging. Second, we are not proactive, which is, I think we pay a price in our modernization of China. Mm. You can go to India, may be too political or pay a price for that, but Chinese being political, and then we also pay a price of being like that. Mm. Because I think you like it or not, but I think politics or government still play a big role in people's life in today's world. So you cannot say, I have a happy family, I have a happy business, period, and then I'm very contented. Mm. So, it's what it is, yeah.
No, well said. You know, I have time for only two more questions, my friend, even though I can keep talking to you for a long time. So I'm going to select two more questions for you. And I want to come to regional issues like Taiwan and Hong Kong. And in your opening comments, you did mention that China doesn't want to go to the war. The exception is Taiwan. How do regional issues like Taiwan, Hong Kong, Macau, rooted in domestic policy, play out China's broader foreign policy?
I think Hong Kong and Macau is not an issue, okay, at least for the time being, for China. One, the place is too small. Mm. And second, the people there are quite sheepish in terms of political ambitions. I mean, you don't find people, even the opposition party in Hong Kong, have a huge political ambitions. No, you don't find that. And the size is too small. Mm. And they're within the control of China. So that's easy. Xinjiang or Tibet, but then Xinjiang is an issue. Tibet is less an issue. Mm. Xinjiang is an issue because of the religions, because the influence of the Muslim countries and so forth. So China is very concerned about that. Mm. But I think this is something that we need to carry for a long, long time. Mm. Taiwan could be a time bomb. Taiwan could be a time bomb. I hope the economy will not go south for China, and then Xi need to explore other way to divert their attention. I mean, that will be the worst case. And the chance when people like postulate that theory, last time I used to say that's a 0.5 probability. But now I would say this is a 5% probability, still low. But we cannot rule it out. And Xi have this legacy thinking, or I need to leave my name in history with a good reputation. Mm. So all the people that he will do something before he go to heaven, and potentially it could be drastic. Yeah. Mm. And if you look at the way so far he has been conducting business, on one hand, he's practical. So if he sends something that is a threat to the party, he will change course. Mm. Look at the turnaround in the COVID measure, right? Friday, the COVID is still our biggest enemy. Monday, nothing. There's no nothing called COVID. So, yes. So I think that sharp turnaround is not a concern of him. But that could also be very dangerous because you can't really plot his every step in with a smooth curve. You cannot say if you do A, then he will do B. If you do B, he will do C. Mm. From A, he could jump to F. and then that's very hard for outside observer to try to gauge what he's going to do next. Mm. And go back to my earlier point, I think Taiwan is the time bomb.
Mm, well said, well said. And what are my last question to you? What, in your view, are some of the long-term implications of President Xi's domestic-driven foreign policy on China's position in the global political landscape?
It's It's funny. I have some friends who is a big supporter of the Communist Party.
Yeah.
And I have some friends that hate the Communist Party. I mean, being live in Hong Kong, I mean, there's people like that. Some
and,
of
and,
them.
And that is normal. I'm a big supporter of the BJP, and there are my friends who hate the BJP.
Yeah. For some of the CCP hater tell me that, oh, we are so glad to have Xi Jinping because it shortened the life of CCP by 30 years.
Right.
Because, okay. And so things are, the plus minus are side by side. So you see something very, you think, oh, today is so powerful. But because it's so powerful, it could also lead to his demise, lead to his accelerated demise. And I think I'm quite neutral in that sense, but if you ask me, the control of public opinion that tried by the government, sometimes you lose the pulse of the people. And when something blow up, because you don't have a let go apparatus in the, or venting outlet in the past,
right?
Blow up could be much more severe than you or for the time also have a venting device for all this pressure. Yeah. So
amazing.
I'm concerned because I'm hoping for the better of China. And a better China will be a better world for everyone.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I've often said this, that 1.4 billion people in China, 1.4 billion people in India, that is 40% of the world.
Yeah.
And if we can get to trading between the two of us beyond our $150, $160 billion, these are going to be very big markets. But then there are always politicians. But on that note, Water, thank you so much for speaking to me about...
Thank you, Ashtosh.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
I look forward to another conversation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.